Well, thank you for getting up so early on this last day of the conference and for maintaining a sense of humor as well. I'm going to talk to you today about a project that my colleague Stacia Fisher and I did on co-payments. Some of you may have heard us talk yesterday on more or less on the method of the paper, so I won't dwell on that too much, but I really want to I thought it was appropriate for the public health nursing section to really try to increase awareness about this policy, its consequences, especially for communicable disease, and what it means for public health nursing. We have no relationships to disclose. The United States incarcerates more people than any other country in the entire world. I mean, even more than Russia, China, everybody. At mid-year 2009, one in every 300 black women was incarcerated, one in every 704 Hispanic women, and one in every 1,099 white women. Then that's not California, I'm sorry, that's a typo. And that's from the Bureau of Justice Statistics this year. And actually, women are, although there are fewer women in jails and prison, their incarceration rate is growing at a faster rate than men. So the cost for taking care of prisoners is phenomenal. It contributes to the financial situations in many of our states, especially in California. In California alone, we spend about $2 billion a year for prison health care. And I will tell you, I recently was looking at a report from the California Department of Corrections. This is not a very scientific way to put it, but there was this enormous pie, and the little slice for health care was not very big compared to all the rest. So it gives you an idea of how much it costs. And so healthcare co-payments have come about, just like in managed care, as a means to allegedly contain costs. Although there's been an audit report in California by the state auditor that showed that the cost to administrate the healthcare co-payments was more than what they brought in. And these are fees that prisoners pay for healthcare, usually $3 to $5. We've done some calculations, actually, and it's in a paper that's published. Anastasia's the first author. It's in Women's Health Issues. And it, you know, these prisoners make like 10 cents an hour at most. You're really lucky if you make a dollar a day if you're on the fire crew. So if you compared that to a $60,000 a year salary, I mean, if you looked at it equivocally, they would be making a co-payment, or we would be making a co-payment of about $2,000. So it's pretty absurd. And these are generally poor people. They come from poor communities. And so their work in jail or prison is one way they get money. Sometimes their families can give them money. But even then, it's not very much. They're poor families. And there's also restitution that's taken. And I'll show you a slide later about that. So proponents argue that these co-payments contain health care costs. But evidence suggests, as I told you from that auditor report, that the cost of implementing the co-payment policy exceeds any savings. And by the way, the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare has a statement recommending no co-payments, and as does the American Public Health Association in its standards of care for jails and prisons. So the purpose of our research has been to examine how women prisoners access health care in jail and prison. And in this, I'm really kind of putting the data together from two studies. We've used community-based participatory research, and we've analyzed our data using grounded theory. We've done focus groups. We've transcribed them verbatim. And we've had co-researchers through this process from a local grassroots agency. And all we've done about 16 focus groups over the last couple years. And in our sample, we have 49 former prisoners and 60 prisoners that were in a county jail. And basically, our sample is very similar to the national sample in that over 50% are non-white, which reflects the ethnic disparities in our country. So our study findings have been that these co-payments impede healthcare access. And yet we know as public health nurses that control of communicable disease requires timely and reasonable health care access. But co-payments act as barriers to seeking appropriate health care. We have found that they adversely impact prisoners' health, and they worsen health disparities by leaving prisoners sicker than when they entered prison. So I'm going to show you about four examples of when prisoners had some sort of communicable disease and how the copayment impeded their care. First of all, as I was saying, many prisoners lack the money for a copayment. This one woman said, "I've been in jail and I had a cold and the flu, and people tell me, well, you have to pay, and I don't have any money on my books. And I just sat there and coughed on a cell wall, and I was sick, but I didn't have any money, so I just suffered." You know, just as a point, just as a note, last year we had a major outbreak of H1N1 flu in our women's county jail. The jail was closed. I mean, it impacts staff and families, et cetera. As I mentioned, prisoners pay restitution, which limits the money they have. They already take 55% out of your money. So if $100 comes in and you're only getting 45, and that's supposed to last you for a whole month. So if I need hygiene products and I need soap and stuff, I already went to the doctor twice and I have something come up, I'm going to be very reluctant to go to the doctor. So, you know, for every dollar, 55 cents is going towards restitution. In fact, we have a prisoner that we have visited in prison, in a California prison, who we said, well, what can we do for you? And she said, don't send money because of the restitution. So actually, she asked us to send stamps. So we've sent stamps so that she can write letters. So women often do not report health problems, hoping to use the money for other purchases. This is similar. This woman had a bad cold right before I came out, and I didn't want to spend the money that I had because I knew I needed it for bus fare, and I didn't want to be negative without money when I came out. You know, just to give you an idea, in our county jail, and again, these are poor women, the stays are often short, less than a year, and it might be much shorter than that. You know, in the United States, there's about a million people who pass through our jails. The time is very brief. In this particular facility, they're often released at night, even though some advocates have really argued for letting them out in the morning. Like if your sentence is up on a certain day, they'll let you out at midnight, you know, after midnight that day. So there you are in this place that's, I mean, far out from the main part of the city, and you have to go out and you have to catch a bus, really, to get back to San Diego. So she didn't want to get care. And prisoners reported paying for TB tests. I know this is pretty shocking, I think, as a public health nurse. There was a TB scare, and I put in an inmate request, and you get a TB test, and you've got to pay for that. That's what I did because I was in a room with two people that tested positive for TB. Yeah, it was about $3, and I had to go get a TB test. When we started this study, they were not testing for TB in this facility. And, you know, I even met with some of our local public health people who were completely unaware of that, which I think has to do with something we've been talking about in our jail and prison health group, in that the health care that's given in prisons and jails is often under law enforcement, Department of Justice. I mean, in county jails, I mean, our county jail comes under the Sheriff's Department. So that the public health department really operates as its own entity and really doesn't know what's going on in the county jail. They're not talking to each other. And I would bet many of you in the room have had similar experiences. And yet, you know, if we look at some major bodies who are talking about setting standards for jails and prisons, you know, the Health and Prison Project of the WHO, one of their strategic objectives is to reduce the exposure of prisoners to communicable diseases, thereby preventing prisons from becoming focal points of infection. And we would argue that co-payments serve to increase the exposure to communicable disease. We talked last year, actually, at a WHO HIP, or Health and Prison Project, meeting in Madrid that was just focused on communicable disease. So the restricted healthcare access that results from healthcare co-payments increases the risk for women contracting communicable disease. We also would argue that it violates women prisoners' human rights and that it's an issue of health justice because as a consequence, they're not, they don't have fair and equal access to health resources. And you can also look at this as a form of punishment. And we've been shifting our sort of analysis of this, my colleague Stacia will be talking more about that. But the courts have found that a lack of adequate TB control, with a lack of an adequate TB control strategy, violated the rights guaranteed under the 8th and 14th Amendment. And this was about, this was a case of prisoners who were exposed to TB while they were incarcerated. And that quote actually is from one of Paul Farmer's books. And he writes a lot about TB in jails and prisons. It's really quite interesting. You know, and how the exposure to TB becomes punishment. And he reminds us that prisons have gates, but they're highly permeable institutions with a great deal of interaction with surrounding communities. So, I mean, he writes about how jails have become the focal points for tuberculosis in various cities, in the United States as well. I mean, this isn't just in Siberia. So, what is needed? We would argue that women need access to health care that is fairly and equally distributed. In other words, health justice in jail and prison and in the community as well. So, I mean, here are women who we know they have health disparities when they come into jail and prison. You know, our data indicate that they get sicker while they're in jail and prison, and we're not alone. That's fairly well substantiated in the literature. And then they go back to these communities that are already stressed. I mean, we know what community clinics are like. We recommend that we need to look at why we're putting so many people in jail and prison in the first place. You know, we need to have an upstream approach, and we need to use more alternatives such as drug, mental health, and homeless courts and other community-based options to minimize exposure to communicable disease. And we need more research to identify the pathways by which prison and jail policies damage health. Oh, I have nothing to disclose. I think I showed the disclosure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. I think you're supposed to say that as well.
Okay. We have nothing to disclose.
Well, okay. Questions?
I have a question.
Not to this audience, anyway.
Yes. Oh yeah, yeah. In our state, there's a huge. Listen, I'm a card-carrying union member, but there's a huge custody union in California. Custody union that really is very, very powerful and supports the proliferation of jails and prisons in our state. And there are also a for-profit prisons. You know, we have private prisons. And I would just call all of your attention to a recent story that was presented in NPR. Maybe some of you heard it, about an organization called ALEC. It's an acronym, A-L-E-C. And right now I can't remember what it stands for. But they discussed in that story, and I can send you the link if anybody wants it, how people in legislators from Arizona sat down with the Correctional Corporation of America to write the anti-immigration law in Arizona. And it describes how corporate America influenced the legislation in Arizona. You know, and I think when we see this in the media, we instantly assume, oh, these people in Arizona, I mean, depending on our political stance, but, you know, they're just anti-immigrant, they're racist or whatever. Well, that may indeed be true or not true, whatever, but there's even another layer under that of corporate America informing the legislation, which leads to more detention, immigrant detention facilities, which is a huge business in our country, and they participated in this. And this we see as an issue of justice. Yeah. So you're right. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Applies to, I'm sorry.
Males.
Yes, they make cook. Yes. Yes.
Absolutely.
Is there some big difference in patterns that may affect how we should see it between men and women?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I think we would argue a couple things. First of all, there's actually a fair amount of documentation that women prisoners are sicker than men prisoners. They have higher rates of HIV, higher rates of sexually transmitted disease, and actually higher rates of mental illness, documented mental illness. So for that reason, they have more health disparities. You know, I mean, they're worse than the general population and even worse than men. And we also know that women in the general population access health services more than men. So that, I bet certainly it's as equally punitive and applicable to men.
Yeah. Now, a comment question. When you think about rehabilitation, which I know is politically involved.
We've lost the R. Yes.
But it's nevertheless very important and worth arguing for.
Yes.
One could emphasize not so much the moral qualities of rehab, but the physical.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
If people are not coming out of prison healthier than they went in.
Right.
Yeah. Score against the prison.
Yes.
Is there any potential at all to get someone more independent to measure those things and then fight for policies to bend the prison system to improvements?
We're looking for that person right now, yes. we are. But you are absolutely right. And prison health is public health.
Right.
You know, Alex Gatherer, who's, you know, part of the Health and Prison Project, has written widely about this. And I mean, I think it's part of what I was saying earlier, that prisons and jails don't come under, you know, health agencies. It reminds me of when I worked with the Indian Health Service. If you look at the history of the Indian Health Service, it used to come under the Department of the Interior. And it was when they moved it to Health and Human Services that at least it had a different philosophy. When your philosophy is custody, control, and punishment, you're not thinking about health. But you're right. Yeah. Have I taken up too much? Do we need to?
No, I'm
time? Okay. No, no, go ahead. I think Deborah whispered.
I was just curious about pregnant women. Are they given any benefits?
Okay. Well, yeah, that's a very good question. And actually, the co-payment is not supposed to apply to pregnant women. Yeah, you're not supposed to have to make a co-payment to access services if you're pregnant. In the county jail where I live, you know, if you indeed you are pregnant, you get like an extra snack a day. You might not have to work, and I mean, there's some other promises. But you know, I mean, we have data from our jail focus groups where they would refuse to test women for pregnancy. You know, so, you know, one of the things we've really found is that this stuff is really variably, the administration is variable.
Delayed abortion.
I mean, abortion's a huge issue in jails and prisons.
The data is not very pretty on this topic.
Yeah. Mm. And people have written about the abortion issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah, we did try to address that yesterday, but let me just summarize briefly that it's all community-based participatory research, and I'm glad you asked that. All of this work came about because a former prisoner working with this grassroots agency came to us and said, you know, we really want some help, and we've got to do something about the health care in the jail. And I will say that because, and they have worked with us, it's community-based participatory research, they helped design the study. I mean, our whole question about the co-payments came from them. And it's really because we found it in the first study, we tried to move on in the second study, but they wouldn't let us. They still wanted us to, they said in our community advisory board, this is what we want to study. And so they designed the question. I mean, they designed the focus of the study. So then they helped us recruit. They helped us recruit people. They helped find us places to meet for the focus groups. They helped us design the questions. They looked at our data analysis. And with them, we have gone back to this particular facility and said, you know, look at these co-payments. And, you know, we've tried to focus on communicable disease and especially psychiatric care. And one of the things that the jail has said, you know, that they've changed the policy and that women with psychiatric care don't have to make a co-payment. Well, we're still monitoring, you know. I mean, we feel like our work has just begun. Yeah, so you've had your hand up for a while.
I guess my question is, what the heck is the health department?
Uh-huh.
Our health
department's
really not thinking about, you know, STDs,
TB.
Right. California is so bad. There was somebody dying every week in our state prison system.
Or negligent death.
You know, they were iatrogenic deaths. Uh-huh. They caused them. So it's in a receivership. I mean, the federal government has, federal judge basically said someone else has got to take this over.
Right. But this is still what's going on under the receivership.
But it's still right.
Yeah, I mean, it's better. And, you know, we'd like to be hopeful. But I think it's part of the issue that I mentioned before, that this is administratively, this is under corrections. It's not under, you know, we need better, I guess our other recommendation is that public health nurses need to link with county jails. And we're maybe skewed. There are other jails that are much better than ours.
What was that anyway?
Thank you. If there are further questions, let's hold them until the end. And I just want to remind everybody that I have nothing to disclose either.